Good evening, everyone, and welcome. It is so good to see your presences on the screen and to share with you a common intention for the fullness of life. So we come together from near and far, sharing and bearing our gifts, our longings. And in this year of holy unknowing, we yet know that there is light. There is choice, there are laws, and there are possibilities. And so we come together in that hope and in that knowing. In lighting the Christ candle, we affirm the presence of Christ with us. And we call upon the conscious circle of humanity to gather with us and inform us. So we begin in the name of the Father and of the Son and in the name of the Holy Spirit, God transcendent, God omnipresent, and God immanent, the Holy Living Trinity. Amen. So we begin our evening again in the memory and celebration of the life of Thomas Keating, who was very close to this community. Born March 7th, 1923. We celebrate his 101st birthday. And tonight we will read a poem in the back of his book of poems published as The Secret Embrace. It is the last poem that is shared in the book and also the shortest. Maybe you recall that we begin our centering preparation every week by saying what each of us matters. And this gives context, really, to that phrase. Father Thomas's poem is entitled, What Matters? And he says, only the divine matters. And because the divine matters, everything matters. So happy birthday, Father Thomas. May we come to know this in our own book of life. We do prepare ourselves now to be present. And in so doing, we are building a container of intention. What each of us brings matters. How we come matters. How we participate matters. So now we place ourselves here and now with intention and immanent trust and receptivity to the influences coming from the circle of conscious humanity. And we prepare to receive these influences without effort, rather with receptivity. With back upright, heart opened, mind quiet, and directed attention. Body relaxed, noticing and then letting go of any tension, constriction, resistance. Open. And we breathe in deeply all every most hidden part of our being, all being, everything, everything that passed through us this day, our world today, everything that hurt, that confused, that created fear, that brought heaviness, that left us feeling powerless, less than, more than, everything. Everything that uplifted, that loved, that brought joy, surprise, all affirming, all denying, and we hold it as offering. Reconciled as food for being. We lift it and ask that all be transubstantiated in our being as food, as whole, as lovely, as radiant, as beloved of God. We do this on behalf of everyone and everything, and we breathe out this healing light into the world, all worlds. I hand over all complexities. I hand over all plans. I hand over all anxieties and small fears of my heart. I yield to the divine human life. I am here. I am. I wish. I can work. I stand unencumbered before God and one another. And so it is. So now we will participate in the prayer of Lectio Divina. Reading a passage from today's email, it will be read three times with a silent pause between each reading. And each time we're invited to listen to what it's gifting us with. What is ours to receive for our journey at this time? For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now, and not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly while we wait for adoption, the redemption of our bodies. For in hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait with it, for it, with patience. Every developing process passes through steps between a higher or finer quality of energy and a lower or coarser quality. This notion of a ladder of energies is represented in the idea of a great chain of being stretching from inanimate objects up to the angelic spheres. We may speak of the evolution of man as the process by which human beings become able consciously and voluntarily to serve the purposes of higher, perhaps the highest intentions in the universal world, intentions that create and maintain worlds upon worlds in the universal world. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labored pains until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly while we wait for adoption, the redemption of our bodies. For in hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. Every developing process passes through steps between a higher or a finer quality of energy and a lower or coarser quality. This notion of a ladder of energies is represented in the idea of a great chain of being stretching from inanimate objects up to the angelic spheres. We may speak of the evolution of man as the process by which human beings become able consciously and voluntarily to serve the purposes of higher, perhaps the highest intentions in the universal world, intentions that create and maintain worlds upon worlds in the universal world. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly while we wait for adoption, the redemption of our bodies. For in hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. Every developing process passes through steps toward between a higher or a finer quality of energy and a lower or coarser quality. This notion of a ladder of energies is represented in the idea of a great chain of being stretching from inanimate objects up to the angelic spheres. We may speak of the evolution of man as the process by which human beings become able consciously and voluntarily to serve the purposes of higher, perhaps the highest intentions in the universal world, intentions that create and maintain worlds upon worlds in the universal world. And so it is. You're invited to share with us what you received from this passage, or perhaps from the image, and we will all receive your gift. Good evening and welcome, Melba.
Good evening. I love the connection to the divine matters, because everything matters. And then reading this, reading these, it connected, you know, even the words that you say in the very beginning when we invite our conscious collective. Once we become consciously connected, I feel like in a way, the reading was asking us to not only be consciously connected, but consciously consent to, you know, being fed and nourished from our ancestors, from spirit, from the angelic realm. And if we do that, we are in a way learning a kind of a conscious loving kindness about what is happening in our world, or, you know, people that we don't that we maybe mechanically get mad at when they pass by us really fast, or they make the wrong turn. It feels like if we are consciously consenting for information and inspiration, that we really are children of God. We take on that type of approach to our lives, because it's there's so much to understand. So I liked the reading. It was just beautiful.
Thank you, Melba. Thank you. Yes. Who else would like to share? Howard, welcome.
And everyone. And that was, boy, that was just packed full. I'm getting lost trying to remember what all I thought of while I was in there listening to it, and involved in listening to it, I guess. The one of the big things that came out for me was the energies and the passing from inanimate objects all the way up to the angelic levels. And I watched a little series, I think it was on Gaia or something, about energies. And they went through and showed how the energy of the earth has a amplitude and a frequency, and as we do, and like that, our heart has a higher force, higher amplitude than our brains do. And then it showed that the earth's frequency was in a line, synchronized with the frequency of the human heart. And that just blew me away. And that's exactly what I felt when you were reading that, especially that one section on the different levels of energy, and they all are different, and at the same time, they're unified, is my feelings.
Yes, all of them are needed.
Yes.
Yes, thank you, Howard. Thank you. Lisa, good evening. Welcome.
Good evening. Nice to see you, Marianne.
Yes, likewise.
To see everyone. What I heard was hope for what we do not see, and we wait for it with patience. And that is a spiritual journey. That is faith in the unseen and being patient and waiting. And then also during the third reading, I heard that creation waits with eager longing for the revealing. And what that felt to me is I'm waiting patiently. Creation is waiting patiently for me, revealing for the opening up. So it was just a beautiful reading. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you. Ken, good evening.
Good evening. Well, just following what Lisa was saying, for the first time, I really had kind of this visceral connection with hope and this kind of inevitable decay. And the first reading, when it talks about this decay, I was kind of seeing the decay in human society. And I was, as we were going through the readings, I was connecting that with my own personal journey and observing the decay in the personality and the decay in the body, and that what that feeds is not seen. And to a large degree, only I know. And I it just gave me hope for humanity that this decay that maybe we perceive is feeding something higher. And anyway,
May it
that's
be
what
so,
I took away.
Ken. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, Deborah or Don?
Hi, Marianne, it's Don. I heard after sitting patiently and listening to this and reading it this morning that I was reminded of patience is the mother of will.
Yes.
And in this reading, it talked about the will of the Father and how not only is creation groaning, but so are we, so is humanity too. And it's really good to be reminded that it's okay to groan, but just don't get identified with it and just be patient
Yes.
and never give up.
Thank you, Don. Thank you. So, Jack.
Okay, can you hear and see me?
I can't see you yet, but I can hear you, Jackie.
Okay.
Good evening. I see you.
This is a very beautiful passage, and the image and the passage itself reminded me of the old Jacob's ladder that we saw a week or so ago, because this seemed to be a more contemporary version of Jacob's
Yes.
ladder. And what I heard was creation has subjected or was subjected to futility. And my question was,
Yes.
what is this futility for me? What am I supposed to know or discern about futility for me? And also, for if we hope for what we do not see, we wait with patience. Hope that is seen is not hope. So this is a mystery. This is the unknown. The magic of this whole year is to recognize that the entire journey has been to finally discover that we don't know. After all these years of thinking we were supposed to know, my entire life up to the time I came to the church was the expectation that everybody else knew, but I didn't. And then I was supposed to know something. So there is real magic in this. And this energy, the ability to come under scale and to discern to the best of our abilities, as limited as that might be, where we are in this scale, as insignificant as that is the whole thing. And to just simply hope, to have faith, because God will carry us the rest of the way.
Indeed. Thank you, Jackie. Thank you. And Frank, we'll take you as our last person in this section, and Karen and Diane, perhaps it will be a time for you to share a little bit later on in our evening.
I need to do something.
I felt the whole reading was about humility. And the key to that, to me, was the statement that we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit grown inwardly while we wait for adoption. That we must remember that what we've been given is a blessing, but it is just a start. Mm-hmm. Just a start. There's much, much more to be done. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you. And thank you to everyone, because I know that we each receive something from this passage and have it in our hearts and can resonate with the whole group just by having received it ourselves. So thank you. Thank you for being here. Now it is actually my joy to welcome Steve Utz, who will accompany us in our continuing journey into being and becoming. Welcome, Steve, and good evening.
Well, thank you, Mary Ann, and welcome everyone. So let's begin with the homework from last week, Donald's presentation about being and how being attracts our life, Thomas Keating's diagram of the circles of levels of being, and the commentary on that. So any thoughts from your experience with this last week? Virginia.
Okay, when I was watching the video of Thomas drawing his circles, all of those things are in my cellular memory. But what came to me was when he got to the circle about ground of being. I had never heard that concept before, and apparently I was more ready to hear it. But it's so inclusive. And that's what I'm going to say. That was the impact it had on me back then and still to this day, how inclusive we are with our God and everything, each other.
Yes, see, I think God meets us where we need to be met. And it's up to us to keep climbing in. But thank you. Thank you, Virginia. Jim. Yeah, I'm on mute. Yeah, there you go.
Good evening, everyone. Yeah, mine took a different turn when it talked in the homework. And I kind of got some delight because I was able to mix the Lenten season with the work. And sometimes I have a hard time doing that, sometimes not. But basically what came up was, I know it talks about prayer, almsgiving, and what else is there? There's a third one. Oh, the fasting. And so the almsgiving, I was thinking about what can I do as far as maybe volunteering, doing something. But then I had, I guess after one of the sits, all of a sudden it came to me. I had a couple of friends that I've been working on their finances a little bit. And what I was seeing was that they were paying like 29%. And so I thought, I'm in my third year of retirement as a social worker. So obviously I don't have $1 million set aside like some folks, but I thought, you know, that's something I can do. And I've never been a person that's been connected to money, I thought. And I drove a Kia Rio for 13 years until last year it finally gave up on me. But so I did that. I won't go into all the story of it. But then the surprise, and I had such a freeing, just being able to do that freed me so much. But within a few days, I kind of got a lesson as I got a phone, or I got a text from my credit card company, and they had said, well, there was $69 charged. I go, well, so I called the fraud department. And basically what came down to it was a year ago, I had put in one of these things and I didn't transfer it over as far as, so it ran out and they charged me the money for the new subscription. And I couldn't believe that throughout the day doing my introspective work and looking at myself, how much that came up for $69, how much that affected me. And it kind of gave me a lesson as to, you know, basically on how up and down things can be. But it was definitely a big lesson. And then today, when I was looking at the Daily Word, I'll just read it real quick. It talks about prosperity. It says, I share my prosperity by loving freely, giving generously, and forgiving easily. And I really appreciate that being able to delight in that, of connecting Lent in the work, and just that being that I thought, well, again, one of those maybe buffers that I tend to put up at times, that I'm really glad I was shown that so I can have a future memory. So when those little things come up, matter of fact, I just spent today at the shop and I got to pay $1,300 something to get my air conditioning fixed. But it's almost the delight in knowing, well, that's all I am going to learn. If the lake is very calm, I don't learn much. When there's the boat's rocking, I guess I'm dumb enough, that's the only way I can learn. So I appreciate that.
Well, Jim, thank you. That's actually a great prep for the presentation tonight. It's this law of reciprocal maintenance, and you're contributing to the flow, and yeah, you give up and then you take in, and you give up and you take in. And when you open to that, then, you know, life is less tense and we just flow with it. But thank you. Thank you very much. Jackie or Lee?
I'm going to be speaking from Father Thomas Keating's video, The Level of Awareness, which explains the movement into spiritual awareness and higher levels of being. Last week, Lee and I were bouncing between our ordinary awareness and our spiritual awareness. Both of us are head types, and all day long, we were giving our opinions to each other regarding how we thought something must be done, from how to stack the dishwasher properly to how the air conditioner needed to be set, really important things. We generally have learned to let go by observing where we were going down the rabbit hole into negativity and where we could go through breathing slowly and deeply into our bodies to bring ourselves back to center by knowing this is not I, and to remember the divine indwelling. It was a rare time that we went to bed with the heaviness of our day's exchanges, but after much praying before sleep, we're able to awaken this morning or that morning and greet the divine indwelling in each other. Thank you, God.
Wow. Thank you, Jackie. That's beautiful. It's bringing the centers together. Anybody else? Okay, well, we'll begin with the presentation. And I think I'll go straight to our slideshow. Everyone can see that okay? Okay, so this evening we're going to talk about this concept of evolution and involution. And it's one of those topics that really isn't referenced much in the commentaries. It's not in the most entry access literature of the work. It's sort of near the back end, and it's alluded to a lot. It's alluded to in the concept of influences, what influences we're drawn to. But I'm going to try to unpack this and just try to kind of imagine this as more flow than strict diagrams. So, first diagram here is the solfège of the ray of creation. And I borrowed this from Robin Bloor from one of his previous presentations, where you've got evolution we're very familiar with, the ray of creation that we're supposed to kind of ascend through. And again, where many of us do do, re, mi, and we hit the wall and we just can't muster up enough self-organization to get through that first interval. And then sometimes some of us can get through the second interval through conscious suffering. But involution isn't talked about as much. Robin had a couple presentations on this and actually correlated it with the Lord's Prayer. But I thought I would kind of alter that correlation with a writing in the work that's just absolutely fascinating. There's been classes on it in our school and in our church, the recapitulation of the Lord's Prayer. And when you look inside some of these things that we just take for granted and recite day after day, there's a built-in legomenism embedded in within it that you don't see. I came across this writing of Bruno Barnhart. He's a monk that was at out in California, Big Sur. And he wrote this book called The Good Wine. And it's a kind of a how Genesis and the book of John correlate in this way. It's very interesting things to look at. But this Lord's Prayer, it's a triad of triads. So you've got an invocation. It's like a sandwich. There's an invocation at the top and a doxology on the bottom. And then there's the life, which is the divine incarnation action. Hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. And remember, in involution, the do-si interval is filled in by the will of the absolute. So that's where the will comes in. Now, what happens after that is interesting. It's like, it just really anthropomorphizes this. God sends us on our way, like we're going away for our first day of school. We show on up our little sign, first day of school, and God has packed us a lunch to tuck in our heart. Maybe a love sandwich, maybe a piece of forbidden fruit, and a Tootsie Roll Pop, and I'll get into that later. And we tuck that inside, and that will sustain us our entire life till we return. But it's a long journey, and we have to head out from Eden, so to speak. And so then we get to the way. We're on the way. Give us this day our daily bread. Give us what we need to survive. Give us the impressions to grow. And then learn to not internally consider so much, but externally consider. Forgive us our debts, and we forgive our debtors. We give and take. We learn to flow. We learn to flow with life. And lead us not into temptation. Lead us not into being caught by all the A influences, but deliver us from that temptation. And so that's our part. And that is where God turns it over to us in the side octave. That's the way. And who was the way shower? The way shower was Jesus. So that, in fact, the early Christians, so they were followers of the way. So that's the sweet spot right there. That's where we are going to participate. And then finally, the affirmation of the truth. Thine is the kingdom and power and glory. So next time you just think about this triad of triads, because I think it's a beautiful way to reaffirm ourselves, to remember ourselves. You get to that sweet spot in the Lord's Prayer where you just take it in deeply and then you give it up. And this was in the video from Thomas Keating and was talked about last week, where the conscious circle of humanity, what we derive our divine inspirations, the B influences that come to us come from here. The collective work of people beyond us, the people still living, that carry this tradition almost like a school of knowledge and understanding. And, you know, there's man number 1, 2, 3 that are, we kind of flow in and out of these levels. I don't think we've you pass your SAT to be man number 4 or anything. We flow in and out of these levels. There's times I'm locked into my intellectual center. And then man number 4 will show up occasionally and kind of is waiting at the gate. It's the only gate you can get into this circle, by the way. 1, 2, and 3 really don't. They don't have, you have to be balanced to get in. But once in, there's this school that everybody understands each other, even though they're at different levels, and they give each other space to be that, from philosophical to theoretical to someone who just acts completely all in on everything, you know, like Jesus. Jesus is the man number 7, in my opinion. But what came to mind after studying this is that our role here should have this disposition of benevolence, a benevolence to all creation, an aspirational view, yet a benevolent view to everything that is around us. And I love this quote from Jacob Needleman. The lost element in our lives is the force within myself that can attend to both movements of human nature within my own being, and can then guide the arising of this force within my neighbor in a matter suited to his understanding. And that's really this almost sly man approach to the fifth striving. To assist in the most rapid perfecting of other beings, similar to myself and those of other forms. And that gets lost on us. Similar to oneself and those of other forms, our pets, our animals, all to the level of their sacred individuality. What benevolence is wishing the best for all. And it's a great disposition to engage that flow of evolution and involution. I'm going to explain this slide. It has a lot of stuff on it here. When I was growing up as a kid, this picture, everyone's eyes probably went straight to that picture of Jesus. This painting of Jesus hung in my grandfather's study. I had two grandfathers that were Methodist ministers, and I've shared you the story of my bow tie Methodist minister grandfather who preached to more the common man. This is my other grandfather. He was the Lincoln, brand new Lincoln driving, Florsheim wearing grandfather. And he had more of the upright Methodist churches in places like Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, places like that. But he had this hanging in his wall, and it was in an octagonal kind of gold frame. And I thought it was the most peaceful scene I'd ever seen. And I thought, I wanted to climb up in that painting and sit on that rock right next to Jesus. And it was just so quiet and contemplative. And I think it was described as bedroom religious art. It was just this calm setting to be put in the bedroom. And Jesus is off in prayer, so don't mind me, do what you need to do. But it was just calm kind of a setting. And I thought it was a rare painting, but it turned out it was by this guy, Joseph Untersberger, in the turn of the century, the early 20s, and he went by the name of Giovanni sometimes. And he went instantly, must have been an advanced thinker in art, because he went straight to lithograph. When I looked up Jesus in Gethsemane on Google, this came up on Etsy all over the place. I thought this was a rare painting, and you can get it for $44. But what I love about it, I think it's popular because it's just has this great peaceful feel. And the other thing my grandfather did was he had a typewriter that would have a red tape and a black tape. So all the sayings of Jesus would be typed in red in his sermons, so he could like give it extra oomph. And I guess the apple doesn't fall too many steps from the trees, because I like to do this too. But, you know, Jesus needed to recharge. So the point I'm making here roundabout is that Jesus needed to recharge. He would heal. It was looked down here. They'd come to heal him, hear him and heal, be healed of their disease and to have their unclean spirits cured. And they were all trying to touch him, and the power came out of him and healed all of them. You need to plug back in. And he would have to then go up to the mountain and pray. And now in Jesus's case, as a perfected human being, I don't think it's so much evolution as kind of downloading, like a direct C to B down. It's like a C battery to a B battery, right? And then Jesus was the B battery to the A batteries down below. But this kind of direct download, and that's kind of what I think for Jesus' evolution might have been. He often withdrew to the lonely places and prayed. And it kind of echoes Jacob Needleman's, in a manner suited to their understanding. He'd heal them, some of them. He'd touch their garments, some of them. And he would take the others up the mountain and talk to them. This is another one of those evocative religious paintings from back then. And I was thinking about Matthew's Beatitudes. And extracting from them the ones that weren't kind of an exchange one for the other, like blessed are the mourning. But these things seem to me to be the pure benevolence Beatitudes. So remember that the Sermon on the Mount often is conveyed. In fact, there's a big painting of it at Cedar Break over the fireplace of Jesus given the Beatitudes to the crowds. He only gave the Beatitudes to the disciples. He went off up on a plane up the mountain and gave it to them. He gave to them what they needed to hear. They gave to those others what they needed to hear. And so he, blessed are the meek. Now, meek is oftentimes thought of as weak. It rhymes with it. So we tend to do that with language, as Robin is, Bloor has taught us. But meek is really, and if you translate it into Aramaic, the Aramaic translation is softening the rigidity within yourself, or intentional passivity that we practice in the work. This conscious, play down your judgments and listen, take it in. And blessed are the merciful. Merciful is exchange. So it's flowing again with the reciprocal maintenance, and the pure of heart. It's all those judgments and negative emotion. It's just pure love, a pure, unvarnished heart. And peacemakers, making peace with yourself, the warring factions, aligning things into a sense of purpose, a greater purpose. We can line up behind a greater purpose. We've demonstrated that as mankind. And then, you know, how do you communicate to the crowds? And a classic example we teach all these in Sunday school is speaking in parables. And I'm just fascinated with the idea of parables. And if you look at them on, I've studied this for years because I've been teaching Sunday school for 20 some years, that all the parables seem to be something agrarian, something very familiar to the poor peasantry of the countryside, fishing, vineyards, sowing, planting, occasional robberies on the side of the road, but it's just everyday life, like fables were or fairy tales. And it's a shell that engages the public, and it's up to them to process the deeper meaning. And so in Matthew, it's like, why do you speak to them in parables? And he said, well, to you it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. The reason I speak to them in parables is that seeing they do not perceive, and hearing they do not listen, nor do they understand. They're capable of it, but right now they're not. And they have a influenced worldview. But it's offered to them. And so Maurice Nickel really had a great passage in here in The New Man, the very beginning of The New Man. And it's basically, higher meaning can only be given to those who are close to grasping it rightly. This is one reason why all sacred writings, that is, writings that are designed to convey more than the literal sense of the words, must be concealed, as it were, by an outer wrapping. The parables have an ordinary meaning. The object of the parables is to give man higher meaning in terms of the lower meaning, in such a way that he can either think for himself or not. A parable is also a connecting medium between higher and a lower and a higher level in the development of understanding. So really, you've got this wrapping that's A influence that is containing a C influence. So it comes out as a B influence. And there you go, your Tootsie Roll Pop. So, and this will be a good homework exercise I'll tack on at the end for extra credit. Get some Tootsie Roll Pops, and I dare you to take it down to this level and not crunch through the shell. It's very, very, its temptation gets very intense and very great. So if you can take it all the way down till it's all melted away, and then just bite, and I know it's in the middle of Lent, so I don't want to tempt anyone to stray, but that could be a good homework exercise. And I absolutely love this quote from Emily Cady. I was looking at her date of birth and her death. She was old enough to be Gurdjieff's mother. That's she was born in 1848. That's and she lived to be in well into her 90s. But I love this language and just so bear with me as I read through it, because it's just that kind of 1880s kind of language. Jesus, our master in spiritual knowledge and power, had many hours of lone communication with the Father, and his greatest works were done after these. So may we, so must we, commune alone with the Father if we would manifest the Christ. But Jesus did not spend all his time receiving. He poured forth into everyday use among the children of men in the ordinary vocations of life that which he received of the Father. We must do likewise. For newness of life and revelation flows in faster as we give out that which we have to help others. So I just love that. It's this sense as you start giving it out, it's going to flow in faster. And then now you're a conduit. You're this transmission station. And when you're helping folks, you just resist the temptation to fix. I've learned this the hard way. And so I don't know if you've ever seen this thing on YouTube, but it's his girlfriend has a nail on her forehead and she's complaining of a headache. And he said, if we just take that nail out, it's going to be fine. But she just wants him to listen and not fix it. And it's very comical and absurd, but it's what we do to a lot of folks, not men or women, but how we want to fix things. And a rush to a solution isn't always the best policy. And I want to share a little perspective now culturally about where we're at. This is a book I highly recommend. It's very readable. Yuval Harari's Sapiens. And it's a great high view of the history of mankind from the beginnings of culture. And you get these sense of these eras that we've passed through that we lose sense of because we don't have any sense of, we don't carry a lot of history around anymore. Everything's so up in your face current. But looking back on this map of the cradle of the Bible, the cradle of much wisdom that came from the early millennia of humanity. And this is the Fertile Crescent. So, you know, just to kind of translate the map, this is Turkey over here, and then here's Cyprus, and then there's Syria. This is where Israel and Lebanon and all that, the Levant over here. And then you've got Iraq and over here, Iran. The Garden of Eden was probably somewhere down here. Remember, Ur was where Abraham left to get to Canaan over here. And there was a period in history, it was called the Minoan Warming Period. It was about 3500 to 2500 BC. And there was a lot of water everywhere. The rivers were brimming. The Black Sea over kind of decanted into the Mediterranean, filled it up. And so there was this kind of verdant, mild climate. It was like one of the best climates in the history of the world. And it went on for about 1,000 years. And it seems to correlate with these myths about the Garden of Eden. because foragers were rewarded by, you could go anywhere and all year round and find food and the best fruits, the best fruit trees. So why is forbidden fruit? I mean, you wonder how that got extracted, but that was a Mesopotamian oral tradition myths that were about this wonderful, wonderful period of history, probably handed down in a kind of a nostalgic, wistful way. It's like, remember those times, oh, when we were in Eden, you know, and then there was cooling. And then things cooled up a bit. You had to get clothes on. And then things didn't grow in the winter. So then you had to kind of cultivate the earth. Mm-hmm. And it led to the agricultural revolution. Mm-hmm. And you had to grow, and then store, then protect. And so what happened here? Cain versus Abel. The farmers versus the shepherds. Shepherds and farmers don't always get along. You know, the shepherds watching their fields by night in Bethlehem, because that was winter. It was after the harvest. That was the only time they were permitted there. So you had to have agreements with farmers and shepherds. So, but violence would break out. And then you had to have societies and hierarchies and selling your goods. And it was masculine and tangential. We got away from this feminine hunter-gatherer society that was cooperative and radio in its energy. And then millennia passed, and we get into the Industrial Revolution. And this is all about dominion and exploitation of the earth and of people. And no better expressed than in Gerard Manley Hopkins' God's Grandeur. So I'll just take you through this. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, leered, smeared with toil. And wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, oh morning, at the brown brink eastward, springs, because the Holy Ghost over bent world broods with warm breast and bright wings. So nature is resilient. There have been multiple ecological catastrophes over the history of humankind. A meteor that led to a big dust, meteors that led to dust storms, climate changes, floods, all sorts of things, and even man-made devastation that we're wreaking today. But there's recovery with consciousness. Now I want to kind of shift over these evolution, involution themes, now go to our religion itself and what a little story that I can't shake. I read it some years back, and Bernadette Roberts, The Real Christ, and it just really sat with me. And I reading it again, it's almost like hitting your head against the wall. It's very insistent. It's hard reading. It's tough sledding. She's wonderful. But she's very insistent in her prose, and you have to just read it slowly and maybe take a few breaks. But it's one of the origins between Western and Eastern Christianity, and the the Council of Ephesus in 431 Common Era. So you've got this Eastern church that's growing, and then you've got the Western church that is Pope-based. And in the Eastern church, it's kind of more of an egalitarian bishops or patriarchs or metropolitans, they would call them, that would be in charge of certain areas. And there would be a first among equals, but it was that kind of way. And so in the Eastern church, there were one was an alliance with the Pope, and the other was just kind of a simple monk. So Cyril, the patriarch of the See of Alexandria, was kind of aligned with the Pope. And he took over after his uncle died. And Nestorius, the patriarch of the See of Constantinople, was a simple monk, very pious, very orthodox. And according to Bernadette, and you can look from this picture, this guy, Cyril, he just looks like Uncle in Lion King. He just has an expression that doesn't seem like he's a nice guy. And he wasn't. He was a conniver in behind the scene and convinced the Pope that Nestorius was a heretic. And here was the basis of the argument. Cyril maintained that Jesus was God and had one divine nature. So basically, Jesus didn't suffer on the cross, and he had one divine nature. And that Mary was the mother of God, and that stays with us. Theotokos is Mary, mother of God. Nestorius maintained that Mary, the Annunciation, Mary became aware of her Christic nature, was Christified by God. So she was Christ. They gave birth to Christ. That's how Christ Jesus got his divine nature. And so Christ was the union of two incomplete, disparate natures, divine and man, which Nestorius has had a restitution in recent centuries, because it's more in line with an integrative Christianity. There's a chain of great chain of being. We're all related in so many ways, and that there isn't this break of something that is divine and then the rest of us aren't related. But Nestorius was deposed as a heretic, and he was banished to Egypt, and Cyril became a saint. So go figure. And but the Nestorians, the people that believed this integrative approach, settled in the Middle East. And this is St. Elijah's Monastery that stood between the year 585 and 1743, but then was abandoned. But the monastery was destroyed by ISIS in 2014, which is a shame. St. Timothy of Seleucia was a great binder of this community. And it was just, when you read about this, this is just an amazing community. It was Vladimir Lasky in the Mystical Theology of the Eastern Church was, they never made a sharp distinction between mysticism and theology. And what they would look for is a profound change or an inner transformation of the spirit to experience it mystically. And Sri Aurobindo, an Indian of Hindu and patriot that J.G. Bennett really admired and communicated with, talked about ordinary. This very maps up very closely with the work, the ordinary life, which is the sleeping state led by common habits of the mind and body, the religious life, which can be divine, ignorant human consciousness that are led by dogmatic tenets and rules of some sect or creed, which is formatory, mechanical, and imitative type religion, which most people participate in. And then there's the spiritual life that proceeds from a change of consciousness, a greater consciousness in which one finds his true being and union with the divine. That's evolutionary. So These are all fairly compatible and resonant ideas. And when Gurdjieff traveled in his journeys, it was this very area. I mean, this is the same. This all maps out, this Persian Gulf here, Persian Gulf there, Turkey up here, and Iraq here. And this is where Gurdjieff searched for the miraculous, so to speak. And I don't know whether I'll have to ask Robin Bloor this, but I came across this thing, the Brethren of Purity. It was a secret esoteric school, and it was apparently the Christians and the ascetic Jewish people, the Sufis, and a number of Zoroastrians. They all kind of lived with each other and collaborated and talked amongst each other. And in the end, one group prevailed, and that was bloody. But for a thousand years, they were getting along pretty well. And they say this: in this brotherhood, the self is forgotten. All act by the help of each. All rely upon each other for succor and advice. And if a brother sees it will be good for another, that he should sacrifice his life for him, he willingly gives it. And I love this description of their description of the perfect man: Babylonian education, Hebrew in astuteness, a disciple of Christ in conduct, as pious as a Syrian monk, a Greek in natural sciences, an Indian in the interpretation of the mysteries, and above all, a Sufi or a mystic in his whole spiritual outlook. So it's taking this verdant, fecund kind of diversity that all creation is. All creation is just this bursting with diversity, but reminding us of its unity. And we can build together on this. And there was this fascinating passage in this Encyclopedia of the Brethren of Purity called The Case of the Animals versus Man Before the King of Jinn. And this is just fascinating. It sounds like something like out of Arabian Nights. There was a lawsuit brought by the animals against mankind. And 70 men were shipwrecked on the island Sun, that were inhabited by talking animals who had fled human abuse and exploitation. And these men that were shipwrecked began to subjugate them, and the animals demanded justice. So there was a trial. But Hejaz, who represented the shipwrecked men, wins the case, arguing that mankind has yet to fully realize their potential. And there is a conscious brotherhood with the aim of being good stewards of all creation. So we have to own up to that to this day. But meanwhile, back in Europe, there's the Crusades and Christendom and the Christian Empire and the zero-sum game of power and domination. And the Crusades go on into the second millennia. So to wrap up here, I love these quotes from Michel Conge's Inner Octaves. And he sees us as a transformer. Man is a transformer. A term is very interesting because, just as in physics, a transformer runs with two currents and two directions. Man also inherently has two directions. The human transformer plays its role as part of this larger machine that is the universe. It has its place in relation to the need for transformation of the substances that are required through the action of the will of the Creator. So we find our place in the flow of energies, and we may in different times of our life flow in different energy fields, but but to become aware of how we fit with that. And I love this quote, and it matches up pretty well with this photo of Alexei Navalny. In a sense, life is entrusted to us. Below the initial movement of the absolute no longer intervenes. Remember, after that first interval, the lunch has been packed, and we're on our own, except for our divine center and our conscious circle, which means that responsible beings must appear. There's a need for beings who become aware of this and have such a love for creation and the Creator that no matter how much trouble it causes them, they awaken to be the ones through whom this accomplishment takes place. And I think most of you know who this may be. This is Joni Mitchell. And it's about the time she wrote the song Woodstock. Funny story is, she never went to Woodstock. She opted instead to be on Dick Cavett. Her manager told her that Woodstock would not be a good idea. And so she acquiesced, but she saw the new shots of Woodstock and inspired her to write the song Woodstock. So we've got to get back to the garden. And but I think the greatest song she ever wrote is Both Sides Now. And there now are three stages of her life recordings of this song. The first was written when she was 21. How a 21-year-old could write a song with that depth is beyond me. But it was re-recorded with a more lush orchestration when she was 57 in year 2000, featured in the movie Love Actually, if you all remember. And it has this more midlife Frank Sinatra, September of My Years quality to it that's just lovely. And now at 80, near the end of her life, this was performed at the Grammys, and it was absolutely arresting. And just think about this from the vantage point. So I recite some of these lyrics from the vantage point of someone who's gone through all these phases of life. And if you know how the structure of the song is that she sees clouds like in fantasy figures and candy canes. And then she sees that it rains and snows on everyone below. So you can see suffering from one vantage point, or you can see it from a higher vantage point. Then how love is, and then finally how life is. And this realization, this inner transformation must have occurred in her. And she maybe didn't even know she wrote this lyric until she was 80. She didn't even realize she wrote it until she was 80. But now old friends are acting strange. They shake their heads, they say, I've changed. Well, something's lost, but something's gained in living every day. And then I've looked at life from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's life's illusions I recall. I really don't know life at all. Talk about unknowing. It's life's illusions I recall. My memories are based on, they're filtered through illusions. And then that just gives you sympathy for everybody. Everybody's life is lived through illusions. We're trying to yearn our way back to unity. And so that's the end of the show. Anybody have anything to share? I got to get the gallery view up here. Yeah, Jim.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much, Steve. I appreciated the historical overview you brought into that. And I just wanted to say the Emily Cady quote really was powerful for me. I felt like it was such a distillation of the whole journey. And I just love the just that principle that, you know, as I give, I receive, and just being in that flow. I thought that was a beautiful reminder. So thanks for sharing that.
Sure. Yeah, I thought it was beautiful too. I mean, I love some of her language. I just love Lessons in Truth. It just, it has that, it's almost an amber, but it's just so beautiful. Yeah, Ray.
Hey, Steve, thank you. Yes, I loved the focus on the fifth petition of the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, characterized as external considering. And it really was an aha moment to think about just the flow of generosity and giving outward and being provided for in turn, and how the harmonizing effect that has within me and in society at large. So thank you for that. And the second thing that struck me was when you were reading, you know, the characterization of the dynamic between the farmer and the shepherd, how it reflected itself in the Babylonian civilization. I was thinking about the kind of spiritual source of that, like that, you know, that drove people's personalities and all the circumstance to experience that. And I've heard it characterized as like Abel is the being that, you know, that is taking what God has naturally put on the earth and caring for it and nurturing it. And Cain is the will impulse to alter the earth and kind of work with it of his own accord and till and change and create something himself. And I had this pretty profound epiphany hearing the different stories about how you have the Cain and Abel story where Cain kills Abel. And then later on, you have these recapitulations where the Abel lineage being slays the Cain lineage. And there's like this tension, and it kind of is showing like which impulse is appropriate. And so just thinking about it like that, because I always thought of like, oh, Cain, that's the bad guy. You shouldn't create and, you know, seek knowledge and that sort of thing. But just to see that shift. And one example is Solomon slaying, well, he didn't actually slay, but these assistants working for him slayed Hiram Abiff, who was like the Cain impulse, the builder. And Solomon was having it all provided. And so I appreciated hearing about the Babylonian circumstance. Thank you.
Yeah, it's like right out of Beelzebub. Assured mutual destruction of others. You know, that the Bible's full of that. Well, thank you. Melba.
Thank you, Steve. I wanted to share that I loved your presentation, because I kept getting throughout the whole presentation, I kept remembering what you said, that it was rarely mentioned evolution and involution until the last chapters. And what came to me was throughout, I kept feeling the movement, the cosmic movement.
it's hard to talk about what feeds something and how that moves into like another, I wanted to say like petal, because while you were talking, I kept seeing the cosmic flow as the as Gurdjieff says, the way of the spiral. And the way of the spiral speaks to me in particular, because I paint people as roses. And you might start out with a petal that's you think in a certain way, but then it becomes very connected to all the other petals. And that makes me, you know, remember what Amma used to say, which is, if we saw all humanity as a rose, we would understand that if one of its petals is wilting, we all hurt, you know. And also just thought of how you told us historically the evolution of, you know, religion. But in many ways, I was getting to the evolution created the involution, so that we now can understand that it is about love. It is about the rose, the symbol of love, and how difficult it is to talk about love. We have words like, you know, benevolence, loving kindness, awareness, consciousness, but that's really what is impulsing the evolution to begin with, and the involution. So for me, I know this is a big connective moment for me. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Melba. Well, Marianne, it looks like it's getting close to quitting time.
Yes, it's getting close to prayer time. Thank you, Steve, very much for all the gifts that you bestowed upon us. How very wonderful. Rich food we received. So let us just close our night in prayer and gratitude for what we have shared together. And know that God's love has always met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully, and how blessed I am to simply remember God. Protect us, Lord, while we are awake, and watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and asleep rest in Christ's peace. Amen.